to episode 147 of the Great Escape Minute, the daily podcast where we dig into the Great Escape 1 minute at a time. I'm Rob, and joining me again today is Will Slater of Exploding Helicopter. Welcome back to the show, Will.
Hello, and thanks for inviting me back for another day of the Great Escape.
Well, you're standing next to the propeller, so
you're worried about my safety.
We'll wait and see. Just be careful.
I'll try. What's that draft I can feel in my chin?
Grab it a little bit. Just
gently.
Move your hand to the right. check out what's there. Minute 147 begins with Henley securing the prop crank. Prop crank goes until the plane takes flight. One of the things that I forgot to mention yesterday was in the original script, they actually have the two characters in mechanic overalls, meaning they reach the hangar and somehow get into mechanic's overalls.
Mm. So it's a bit more of a sort of stealth mission where they have to infiltrate the this air base rather than just sort of wander onto it as we see here.
Yeah, and there are no guards that they have to try to get rid of or anything like that. Mm-hmm. So it's always interesting to look at the way that the original script, how it eventually was shot, because it was shot completely different.
Yeah.
Differently here.
I don't know. That seems like a sensible change to me to sort of scrap that.
Yeah, it was more fun to get the Garner Foo, as you mentioned. You called the S, or did you call it Henley Foo?
I called it Garner Foo, but
oh, okay. There you go.
I don't know if we've seen James Garner do martial arts in other films or TV. I don't.
We don't need to. We've seen him do it here.
We've seen him do it. Yeah, he's like ticked off his bucket list and he's done.
Yeah, doesn't it?
I think so. Yeah, why repeat yourself?
Exactly. So we continue from the exact point where we left off yesterday, where Henley helps Blythe put prop crank into the slot, the hole. Basically, the minute ended at that point, and now we see that Blythe moves his hands a little bit, and then Henley actually makes sure that it's in the slot much more securely. And then he continues his inquisitive information to Blythe. And he basically says, when the engine catches, don't move, or you'll get a mouthful of propeller. So actually, if we go to the original script, that line is a little different also. Yesterday, the line started with him saying, when I say go, crank this clockwise. In the original script, basically the whole line is, when I give you the word, you crank. After she starts, don't move until I come for you, or you get a mouthful of propeller. Again, they changed it in a nice way, because it sounds much better the way that it's delivered in the final
it's
film.
A bit, yeah, this is much, what we get here is much tighter, and that's a bit of a mouthful. We don't need that many words to get the point across here, I quite liked it at the moment, because of all the jobs to give a blind guy, hand cranking a propellered plane into action seems pretty cold. Poor Blythe has got no idea where he is in conjunction to these propeller blades. So it's all very Henley's given him the rough end of the stick here. And if I was Blythe, I'd be a bit chalked off here. I'm risking life and limb to get this plane going. And he's not really going to know if he's actually going to have a chance. He's going to live long enough to get in it and fly anywhere.
Yeah, you're completely right. I think Blythe also is the fact that that without Henley, he wouldn't have gotten this far. I think all week he's thinking that.
he might slowly over the course of this week be sort of regretting teaming up with Henley at this point in the escape.
Yes, there is definitely a possibility that you are right there. We'll have to see how things play out and see how that works. Henley gets into the plane, starts doing whatever motions one needs to do inside of a plane. Any people who are aviators that are listening to this know what. Saying that I don't know how to do, so they know how to do it. I have no idea, so I'm not even going to pretend. I don't know if James Garner knew how to fly a plane or not, whether they just told him, okay, move your hands around, make it look like you're doing something.
Who knows? I imagine I like to think in my mind it's a bit like cars, the sort of 35, 40 years ago, where, you know, to start them, you had to pull out the choke and sort of, you know, tickle the engine into life. So I'm kind of assuming there must be some sort of choke-like mechanism inside this particular plane that then sort of engages with the cranking that Pleasance is doing here.
Yeah, that's the way it seems. You know, I've absolutely no idea. Again, I know nothing about aviation. I'm sure Jim O'Kane's listening to this, and you know, he cannot believe that we're actually talking about something that we don't know what we're talking about. So, you know, Jim, write to us. Tell us what you need to do in order to what Henley need to do to get that plane started. And then we actually get to see two more bored German guards, who are apparently in the tower. You know, we can't tell exactly where they are. They look like they're looking down, so they must be at some high level, you know, probably in a watchtower or air tower or air control.
So air traffic control tower, yeah.
And then there's two of them, and both of them are looking, and they're a little surprised, because as we discussed yesterday, they're not expecting the war to get to them. And they're like, what's going on here? And one of them picks up a pair of binoculars, which either he's really, really nearsighted, or they're pretty high up, where he needs to try and figure out, you know, what's going on there. And then the other one picks up a phone. So it's just funny watching the way that the two of them are looking at things. They're not really doing anything about it.
how they're reacting to World War II finally arriving at their doorstep.
Exactly. Welcome to World War II. How's that?
Exactly. They were having such a lovely war up until this moment. And they're like, oh no, we could be in big trouble here.
No, they're probably saying to themselves that the guard down at the bottom is probably in more trouble than them.
Well, that's certainly the line I'd be going with if I was in that air control tower. I'd be putting all the blame on that guard. But I did wonder. I mean, why are they reacting in the way that they are? Because, they might not have expected a plane to be sort of started at this time in the morning. They do sort of become, I don't know, I feel like suspicious very, very quickly and sort of jump into action. I kind of think, you know, they'd be more sort of like, what's that going on down there? And, you know, maybe one of them would be dispatched down there to take a look, or phones on this airbase. One of them, like,
the guy's picking up a phone. Who he's calling, I don't know.
I wondered, you know, is there a phone? Wife.
Saying, I'm
is
not
there a phone
home
in that hangar or something? So I don't know whether they'd phone the guard and say, well, you know, who's that in that that plane down there? So I did wonder at kind of how they, you know, why they leap into action quite as quickly as they did.
Yeah, I think he's calling his wife, telling her, I don't want to be home tonight because someone just stole a plane.
Yeah, I think they're very, very, very possibly. I think, these guys are in for the high jump, you know, once news gets out as what's been going on.
Exactly. Now, one of the things I love about this movie is the detail. So if you look in the shot that they show these two guys in the control tower, so there's two very interesting things that you can see. One is you can see that above them there's a light, and around the light, there's, I guess you can compass, you know, which shows all the different degrees. You know, it has all 360 degrees with arrows around it and stuff like that, which, again, it's great that they're able to keep this detail there, you know, so that when someone's in the air traffic control, they can see more or less from what direction someone's coming. So I found that to be interesting. And also, we can see a very big reflection in the window itself, and you can see
part of the
airfield down below. Yeah. So it's not that. And then we get to see Colin back continuing his cranking. What's really funny is that as soon as it catches, the prop crank either falls out or he pulls it out. But he doesn't wait for Henley to tell him, you know, okay, take it out. Now, again, I don't know how the mechanics of this work. Someone else who probably knows will be saying to me, oh, of course it catches, you know, it automatically just pops out. I don't know. So,
well, I was kind of thinking perhaps, you know, Blythe, you know, at this moment, he's standing right next to a roaring engine. So he's probably thinking, well, I'm getting out of here. So he's probably just yanking it out and stepping away as fast as he can. And I wouldn't blame him for doing so.
And you can also see that there's so much wind that even get to see Blythe's hair, which he doesn't have very much hair, but you can see that there's so much wind that what little hair he has is also moving.
He's in danger of coming off, yes.
Yes, yes. Just don't move to the left.
To the right. Or you get a haircut.
Exactly. And then Henley pulls him back up, and he gets in, and we get to see the guards again, you know, looking down. Again, the guy on the left is still just looking in the binoculars, saying, is this really happening? And the other one's screaming on the phone something.
And just going back to the moment where Blythe gets into the cockpit, I just sort of picked up on that particular moment because, you know, he's meant to be blind, but he seems to know quite where to put his feet from the wing of the aircraft into the seat of the cockpit with a little bit too much psychic foreknowledge. And, it just sort of reminds me sort of what a tough gig it really is if you are a sighted person who is pretending to be, someone who is blind. Because I think for the most part, Donald Pleasel's that off that you know pulls off that performance very well within the film, but there are a few moments within the minutes that we're looking at where there are just these little moments where you just think you don't even move your feet like that if you knew exactly where you need to put your feet. And
I have that on my notes also that he doesn't look as blind as he should when he's climbing into the plane. Okay, we can forgive him for that, you know.
There's more good in his performance than bad here, so I'm perfectly happy to cut Pleasance some slack for that. But one thing I did want to sort of mention with you is, you know, the relationship between Pleasance and Garner, because we've in the minutes that we've discussed so far, you know, Hendley's getting a bit of a bad rap here. It almost seems to be a bit of a bully for Blythe, but in many ways their relationship, I don't know how you feel about it, but you know, for me it's kind of perhaps like the heart of the film. We see, they're within the other characters, they all seem to have somebody who they, buddy up with. And, we have little, their relationships within the film between sort of little pairs of characters. But I don't know, for me, the one between Henley and Blythe, between Pleasance and Garner, that seems to me to be like the warmest one. Now, I don't know whether I'm being swayed by the fact that, they're the central characters of the minutes I'm looking at. I've watched the whole film through a couple of times in preparation for this, and I do think perhaps their relationship is maybe kind of they're the buddiest of the buddies that we get in this film.
Right. Okay. I can hear what you're saying there, and I agree with you. I've had this discussion a few weeks ago. I think one of the things about their friendship and their relationship is that it's something that has come about while they were in this particular camp. Because, for instance, you have Billy, who seem to have been best friends forever. You know, so they're always sticking together. You have Nimmo and Haynes that, they escaped together also. So, and they're both in diversions together. So they work together. So, there are different characters who know that they've been friends before. And obviously, Mac and Roger are also another good example of that with, Ashley Pitt hanging on, the wheel. who, as we discussed last week, it's a good thing he was a third wheel. Yeah. Their friendship is something that we actually get to see happen on screen. So I think that's part of it. And also, Henley's the scrounger. That's a pretty selfish... The work that he has to do is he has to work for himself in order to help everyone else. And you necessarily expect him to volunteer to work with somebody else. He's someone who's best on his own. Like Hiltz. Hiltz is the same thing. He's great on his own, but he still stayed back and helped everyone get out by playing with the rope.
Exactly, because he's Henley is manipulating people, and how he succeeds in what he does, he's all about manipulating people. And so he's quite somebody in terms of what we see most of him doing in this film. He's somebody who's quite cynical. But here he is, as you say, I think it's a great observation in terms of the relationship that we see happens within the film. I think that's a great observation. But here he is, doing something very altruistic for somebody else. So, you know, we get to see a completely different side of his character, and yeah, makes him perhaps a bit more three-dimensional than some of the other people in the film.
Yeah, completely. So I also wanted to bring up something about from the script again. In the script, they don't have the two guys in the watchtower or in the air control room tower.
Mm.
They actually have two German mechanics that is going on. And the script says that the way that they react is they start running towards them, trying to stop the plane from taking off.
Okay.
So there's more of a physical attempt to try to stop them. I mean, here you have these two guys in a tower that are pretty much, even if they were screaming from up there, it's not going to help them at all. One of them at one point is like smirking the whole time. I think the guy on the phone, most of the time he's laughing. Mm. So maybe he's his wife. You know, you wouldn't believe what happened now. Someone just came and stole a plane. Who would have thought that we were in World War II? Yeah, I don't know.
I mean, one thing that might be interesting to mention at this moment is, because I know that you have read the book that this film is based on, and you know, from reading that, this particular scene, this particular moment, seems to be inspired by a kind of a moment that happened to like another prisoner that is mentioned as sort of events that happened previously. So the book, it talks about, a previous prison escape that one of the people who's now sort of, you know, locked up in this Stalag was involved in, where they kind of, you know, try to get into an airbase in order to steal a plane, in order to make their escape. So that this particular scene seems to be sort of inspired by that particular detail.
Yeah, there's no question about that. I mean, it's one of the things that I like about the way that they constructed this whole script is that they took elements from the original real story and adapted them in a Hollywoodized kind of way. I know that there are a lot of people who are unhappy about that, and I will probably have some of them as guests in the near future, in the next few weeks. But irregardless of that, the bottom line is that they know how to make this story a lot of fun. I mean, it wants to see something that is truer to the real escape, then they should see the sequel to this movie, Great Escape 2, The Untold Story, which was a made-for-TV movie from 1988. I think you mentioned to me at one point that you actually saw
it. I have watched it, yes. I have watched it.
But that is much closer to the real story. And now, personally, I'll let you in a few seconds tell us what you think of it. I liked the movie, but I didn't love it as much as this one. You know, I found it to be interesting in the way that they played things out, and we got to see a lot more about the way that various characters tried to escape and tried to get out of Germany and all the different ways that they got caught and stuff like that. This movie focuses more on the planning of the escape. That movie focuses more on what happens once they got out. Obviously, they also have some fictional characters there. They have an American played by Tony... Oh, I can't remember his name. I used to love him on Major Crimes.
Yeah, Tony Dennison.
Tony Dennison, right. He's in there. He plays a pilot that shut down. He's sort of like the Hiltz guy.
Yeah.
Even though there was no real Hiltz. You know, they added him to the story. He played Mike Corey. That's who he played. I liked his character.
That's right, yes.
His character was completely made up. I mean, the movie also has some other great actors in it. You have Christopher Reeve, Judd Hirsch, Ian McShane, Charles Hayde, who most people know from Hill Street Blues, I think. I think that's what he was from. And Donald Pleasance also appears there.
Yes. We shouldn't forget that, because he's the only actor who is on screen in Great Escape 2 that is in the original film. Although I think, isn't the director of Escape 2, isn't he,
wasn't he
an actor in The Great Escape?
Yes, he is. Judd Taylor.
That's
Judd
right.
Taylor plays Plikoff.
Yes.
He's the third token American here that we've seen numerous times. Yes, I love that piece of trivia.
Yeah. But The Great Escape 2, it's a very peculiar movie in some ways, because it is both a remake and a sequel, because this film We get to see the Great Escape happen all over again. So we get to see the sort of, you know, some of the preparations for the escape, the actual escape. But then you're saying there's much more of a focus within that film, probably after about an hour, I think, of the 45 minutes of an hour, which kind of retreads the ground of the original film. After that, we then get to see, I guess, sort of new material or a different story. So we get to see, as you were saying, much more of following some of the prisoners as they try to then get out of Germany or the countries that they then find themselves in. And we then get to see the aftermath, whereby the sort of the war has ended, and now Christopher, the character that's played by Christopher Reeve, is now basically leads a kind of task force. Yeah, leads an investigation to track down and find the people who are responsible for ordering the shooting of all of these prisoners. So it becomes kind of like a sort of police procedural crime investigation type movie. So it's a strange movie in the sense of it's both a remake and a sequel all at the same time, and I don't think I've ever seen a film that is that does both of those things in the same movie.
Exactly. I remember as a kid when I first saw this, I was 14 when this movie came out in 88, and I remember watching it, and I'd already seen The Great, they were first telling us a different story completely, you know, that there was another group of prisoners. Mm-hmm. And I was like, wow, that's so amazing. There's a coincidence that both of these movies, both of these stories had 76 guys get out. You know, and then I eventually figured out that,
totally understandable, mistake to make, because you have Ian McShane's character. I can't remember what
Roger Bushell.
He's Roger. Yeah. I for some reason I thought they changed his surname in this film, but no, you're right.
They changed his name. He's Bartlett here as opposed to Bushell.
Yeah,
because the family wouldn't let them use the real name in this
movie. Ah, okay, that right. That makes more sense. Okay.
Which is interesting that in the sequel or remake, whatever you want to call it, they were allowed to use it.
Mm. Yeah, so I wonder what lay behind that. Whether the families were happier with the kind of version of the story here, or whether some sort of time had passed and they could with just using his real name. I don't know. Who knows what the story is behind that?
Yeah, because it was made 25 years after this movie was made. And what's even more interesting is that it's longer than this movie. This movie is 172 minutes, and
yes,
the movie is 178 minutes. You have an extra 6 minutes, but as we stated, there's a lot more things that go on after the escape itself.
And I mean, obviously, the original film, Great Escape, ends very, darkly with the mass shooting of all these prisoners. But, in some ways, I think The Great Escape 2 is actually perhaps even a darker film than that. I mean, I think the tone of it is very somber, because we see, one of the prisoners who is aided by, I think it's by a French woman. And mm-hmm. she, in order to help the escapee, she is a kind of romantic relation.
She has to seduce.
Exactly, and she then, because she's then seen by other people in the town where she lives as a collaborator, because they're unaware of what she's doing and why. And it's Tony Denison, isn't it, that tracks her down after the war because he wants to thank her. But then, he finds her and she's basically, living this, she's basically ostracized by everybody in the town where she lives, because they all consider her a traitor. And so we see, and there are other moments in that, Christopher Reeve's character sort of becomes almost, quite... is driven by his age in terms of the investigation that he's leading. So we see some really interesting, the cost of what these events had on these characters in a very interesting way in this film, which I think is, makes it a very somber movie. And I think The Great Escape, despite that bleak ending, it does feel, you know, with the music and everything, like a bit of a caper movie. Whereas I think Great Escape 2 has much more serious tone and approach to the story that it's telling, which is, yeah, it's very interesting to watch it as a companion piece.
Yeah, I completely agree with you on that. I mean, this movie, I've mentioned this numerous times on this podcast and even on other podcasts where I've discussed this movie in the past, a year ago, or at this point, it's a year and a half ago. I was on a podcast where we discussed this movie, and it doesn't necessarily feel like a normal World War II, let's hate the Nazis movie. Mm. It's done in a way that the tone of the movie switches back and forth between being somewhat somber and somewhat humorous. You know, they throw in a lot of humorous aspects in this movie to keep the tone of things more fun, I guess you can say. I mean, just use this as a comparison. If you think of two other escape movies, either Stalag 17 or The Bridge on the River Kwai, I mean, those are both darker dramas with the way that they... I mean, Stalag 17 throws in a lot of humor also, but in a different type of way than they do it here.
Yes.
The sequel, The Great Escape 2, doesn't do that at all. There's no, comical moment. Everything is taken very seriously, especially the whole idea of wanting to find the truth as to what happened and who ordered. I mean, that movie even has, you know, the character of Hitler and Churchill. I mean, it shows that this type of story reached those levels.
Yeah, also. And also we see within a bit of a spoiler here for Great Escape 2, you know, we also see that, you know, Christopher Reeve's efforts to track down the people responsible is stymied by the fact that, you know, there are people within the Allied, you know, pouches who want to kind of, you know, protect people because they're useful to them in certain aspects. So they're kind of, they find their investigation thwarted by, you know, people on their own side. So again, speaks, you know, I think that part of the story again speaks to the fact that this is a darker, more somber story that is being told here. And as you say, those moments of levity just wouldn't work within the context of the story that we're getting told here.
Yeah, right. Great. Thank you for bringing it up. That was very nice. We continue with the story of this minute. We'll go back to this minute now. So the plane basically takes off at the very this minute. And the thing that I found most interesting to watch as that plane takes off is that it goes by these two anti-aircraft stations, okay, which are completely abandoned. which goes back to what we were saying about the fact that there's really nobody here.
Yeah, it's the dream posting in the Third Reich, I think, this airfield.
Exactly, completely. You also get to see how many planes are on this tarmac. There's a lot of planes here. So it goes back to our question from yesterday, you know, how can Henley only fly one of them?
And, you know, it'd be...
He was looking for one that had an English man.
Yeah, and you'd be a bit worried, though, wouldn't you, about getting pursued by some of these planes? You've got to think, if all these aircraft are here, there's presumably some pilots knocking around somewhere who could, you know, quickly jump into a cockpit, potentially, and give chase. And, you know, they're sat in a trainer, you know, with no weapons, apart from the rifle they were, you know, finagled off that guard. But I wouldn't fancy my chances with that as the only means of defence.
Me neither. All right, do you have anything else for this minute?
No, I'm all good.
All right, do you want to once again tell people how they can get in touch with you?
Yeah, so come and check out the world of exploding helicopters at explodinghelicopter.com. If you want to hear me talk about more movies, then check out our podcast, which you can find, you know, wherever you get your pods, just look for Exploding Helicopter. And come chat with me on social media at Chopper Fireball.
All right, great. And while you're doing that, you can go rate, review, and subscribe on any podcatcher you might be using to listen to this show. You can send us an email to thegreatminute@gmail.com. Our website is thegreatescapeminute.com. Our Twitter account is greatescapemxm. And our Facebook group is The Cooler. So hopefully, Will, you can come back in tomorrow.
If they let me out of the cooler in time.
You're in the cooler right now. Now you're apparently... You're either stuck in the traffic control...
Well, if I get off the phone to my wife in time, I'll be back tomorrow.
There you go. All right. Okay, well, until tomorrow, tally-ho.
Tally-ho.
everyone, because we're winding down and we have less than 30 episodes left, I decided I'm going to do something very special for the final episode of this podcast. If anyone can please send us any questions, we're going to do a Q&A section, me and one or two other guests. So if you have any questions about The Great Escape, or about doing a Movies by Minute podcast, or about me, or anything that you want to ask, it doesn't make a difference. You can ask us questions. And once we record episode 172, we will answer all of your questions, get them to us as quickly as possible. You know where to send them, as a private message to Facebook, to Twitter, or you can send them to email any which way that we can see the questions and no one else will see them, and we will answer them live for you. Thanks a lot, everyone.